Welcome back to Real World Rewind. This is episode 3, and we're still working our way through Peter Jackson's Lord of the Rings trilogy. This time, we are on the third and final installment of the series, The Return of the King. And joining me this week is Real World Theology's very own Gene Ghostware.
Hey, Blaine, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for coming on. So,
yeah, no problem.
We need to, right out of the gate, talk about the elephant in the room, and that is a little bit about your personal connection to these movies, but also, I think everyone knows you haven't seen the extended edition, so we've got to figure out what's up with that as well.
yeah, everyone knows. Man, getting raked over the coals in the Real World group. Yeah, so yeah, let's get that out of the gate, folks. I have not seen the extended edition. I did make an effort to watch a few clips on YouTube. I definitely didn't get the full sense of it because I was kind of like, well, that's interesting. So yeah, I'm the odd man out here among the Real World staff. I have not seen the extended edition of any of these, let alone what we'll be talking about today.
And that was Gene. Thanks for coming on the show, Gene. No, okay.
Yeah, you're gone.
No, so what's your tell us a little bit about your personal connection to these movies.
You know, I like this question, this element you bring to this podcast, because, you know, Mikey and Josh, when they talked about the first two, they had very specific answers to it. You know, they were able to identify a moment in watching each of those films. And I got to thinking about it, and I really didn't have a moment, because when I first saw this, I was in one stage in life. And when I sought it out to see it again, I was in a completely different stage. So I kind of have to set up where I was at. So this came out in 2003. And at that time, I'm a sophomore at Purdue University. I'm not a Christian. I'm not quite searching for truth yet either. I'm 21 at the time, and I'm doing what you might imagine most 21-year-olds off at college would be doing. So I enjoy movies like most other people, but I'm not really thinking critically about them. So this is how I'm seeing the Lord of the Rings trilogy for the first time. They're just fun movies. They're epic in scale, and there's cool fight scenes and all that kind of stuff. So about the end of 2003 and into the beginning of 2004, which would have been my whole junior year at Purdue, I started studying with one of the elders at a church in Lafayette, which is where Purdue is. And over the course of that year, I come to belief in Jesus. And the first weekend that I'm out of school after my junior year, I'm baptized. And so now, because of that change in my life, I'm seeing things completely differently through a totally different lens. And even my entertainment, I'm noticing more things that relate directly to my worldview now. I'm noticing specific choices of characters that they make. I'm seeing parallels in movies with stories that I am becoming more and more familiar with in scripture. So this becomes kind of a long process throughout like the mid to late 2000s for me, of really discovering my love for movies and what it is, how it is they speak to me, and how it is they speak to people in a way that other entertainment mediums don't or can't. So I'm kind of being molded there over that course of time, and I'm learning other things too, like, you know, C.S. Lewis was a Christian and how crucial that was in shaping his Chronicles of Narnia stories, learning about how Tolkien was a Christian and discussion about how that shows up so strongly in many of his stories. So now I'm seeking out films like Return of the King again and the Lord of the Rings trilogy. And only now it's not just to watch cool fight scenes or anything again. It's out of an eagerness to kind of identify those elements and really deepen my grasp of the whole story to really kind of get down to the root of it. So this whole trilogy, along with many other stories, many other movies throughout that span of time, really played a part in me learning to add some depth to my analysis, thinking critically about movies and the things that I sought out as entertainment. So there are many things, I'm sure we'll touch on a lot of them, that really pop out when you're viewing it with some discernment rather than just for entertainment. So for me, it was a little bit of an eye-opening. I mean, just picture viewing it the first time around just for pure entertainment. That's it. And then watching it again, really looking for a lot of these foundational elements, a lot of these things popping up that you know the authors are influenced by, and just really looking for those. So it was this trilogy played a part in me kind of discovering that level of critique, I guess.
Yeah, I really appreciate you sharing that, the sort of before and after picture, because we always talk about how the gospel affects every aspect of life and of reality and creation. And we sometimes don't think that, yeah, it also affects the way that we view art and entertainment and things like that. So that's a really good thing to share. I also want to talk about a little bit more about Return of the King as a film. I mean, this is the movie that won every Oscar imaginable, 11 Oscars it took home, including, of course, Best Picture. And there was a question that Aaron White asked on the Facebook group of, why do we think this film, instead of the others, won all of the Oscars? Why is this the one to take everything home? What do you think about that?
Well, I think it was no secret when the first one came out that it was, you know, part one of three. And I think that not necessarily that it's so much better than the other two, that's why it's one. I think it's more that this drew the story to completion, and you had character arcs that were coming to a, you know, a full circle. And we were seeing stories get capped off. We were seeing stories end. We were seeing characters go from, you know, like in Aragorn's case, someone who was maybe only looking out for themselves, trying to avoid a sense of destiny and so forth, to now embracing that and fully embracing it to the point where they become a great leader. And that's not quite there in the other films. You do have characters, of course, making really crucial decisions. You have them making decisions that would shape the rest of their journey, but you didn't have that sense of completion. There was still a lot of intrigue going, leaving those first two movies where you knew it was going to be satisfied in the third one. And I think that played a lot into it. If I had to really be pressed and to pick which one was my personal favorite that I thought was the best, it's probably this one, Return of the King, although it's very, very close with Two Towers. I know you guys all like Two Towers, and I didn't get the sense that it was near as close, but I like this one a lot better. Not a lot better. I like this one a little better. It's very close with Two Towers.
Yeah, and I would say it's pretty close for me too. I mean, they're both great, great films, and I completely agree with what you said. I think it's also interesting to look at the other films that were Best Picture contenders, at least the years that The Two Towers and Fellowship of the Ring didn't win, because they were both nominated. And I think the year that The Two Towers was nominated for Best Picture, Chicago won. And if you look at the types of films that the Academy usually chooses to recognize, Chicago is right up their alley, this big, glitzy, glamorous, sleek production about Hollywood, about performances. And so it's the kind of film they like to honor. And then I think the year before that, it was A Beautiful Mind, which is that sort of sentimental Forrest Gump type almost story that has a lot of heart. And so these are just the kind of movies that the Academy typically chooses to honor. In addition to what you mentioned, like I said, that these three movies were bankrolled together as one big production. And so you see all of these narrative threads from the first two movies coming to completion here. So that plays a big part in this as well. I think the year that Return of the King won, there also weren't a lot of other strong contenders up for the Best Picture nomination. At least I know Seabiscuit was nominated that year. And it's just one of those sort of, I hope this isn't one of your favorites now, because I'm gonna insult it a little bit, but it's just one of those sort of like empty sentimental films, at least as far as my memory of it goes. And then you've got things like Master and Commander that may be fine films. In fact, I enjoy Master and Commander, but
me too.
But nothing like this movie.
No, so. You didn't have any real knockouts that year to go along with Lord of the Rings. I mean, Master and Commander, I think, is going to be a memorable one. But she also had Mystic River, Lost in Translation.
Oh, yeah.
Nothing that I think in 10 or 20 years anybody's going to look back and say, man, how did this one not win over Return of the King? I mean, Return of the King was, I think, the clear-cut choice in that year.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Well deserved. And it's one of those movies that never ceases to move me. I mean, I watched it this afternoon to keep it fresh right before we started talking about this, and my wife and I cried as we finished it, even though we've seen it plenty of times and
yeah.
We know exactly what's going to happen. So, well deserved Oscars all the way around.
Between you and Mikey, we have the waterworks covered.
Right. Yeah, definitely, definitely. So let's dive into this movie a little bit. Is there anything that just you want to talk about initially that stuck out to you on a thematic or a theological level that maybe you hadn't noticed before?
So a few things that I remember from prior viewing it, a few things that just watching it the other night jumped out additionally. The first one, I'll touch on a few. I've got like 8 or 9 specific scenes or character decisions written down here that are I think really scripturally important, real scriptural elements seen here. And the one is that in both Two Towers and Return of the King, you have a lot of shots of an act of cleansing, and particularly in battle scenes. So if you think about Helm's Deep, and Josh highlighted this really well in last episode, but the way that Gandalf led the Rohirrim down the hillside and just purged out that valley of all the evil, all the orcs, or at Isengard when the Ents let loose the river, and you just see it literally washing all things clean, extinguishing fires, and baptizing the land.
Yeah.
Okay. So talk about an on the nose metaphor right there. And then finally in Return of the King, the battle for Pelennor Fields, the horsemen from all clans and all nations of men that Rohan was able to assemble just washed over the armies. And it's such a beautiful shot as they're coming down that not quite as steep a hillside as in Helm's Deep, but they're coming down and they're just sweeping out across all these armies of Uruk-hai. And it's just a scene of the evil is being extinguished. It's being washed over. It's being cleansed. And I think that's a really strong metaphor right there. Another one, think about again back at Isengard at the very beginning of Return of the Kings, Treebeard talks to Gandalf about regeneration. He says that new growth will occur here. You know, they're standing in a few feet of water. He says new growth will occur here. New life will come. Trees will grow. Saruman's power is gone, and the soil has been prepared, you might say, to allude to a parable that Jesus used.
Yeah.
The soil was ready now for new planting, for new enrichment. So I thought that was cool. You got regeneration happening there. And we can go on and on. We've got, you know, redemption in the mountain spirit army that Aragorn seeks out. You've got themes of destiny and purpose in Aragorn himself. Of course, a lot of lines. Elrond says to him, put aside the ranger and become who you were born to be. So that sense of purpose and destiny really playing out in Aragorn there. You've got sacrificial service of both Sam and Frodo, and that being shown as a noble thing. Sam's undying dedication to his friend, and as something that is worthy of gratitude. You know, at the end, you talked about a scene I'm sure you were crying at, when in the kingdom of men, they all bow down to these four little hobbits, the least of these, giving thanks to them.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of specific moments that I think really, and especially like I said before, knowing these themes in advance from a Christian perspective and being familiar with the scripture that talks about redemption and cleansing and all these things, they really start to pop out when you see it again. A lot of these are things that when I first saw it just kind of went right over my head, or maybe I just kind of made a mental note of it. So these are all things that I think are really strong scriptural elements there that that we can tie back, and we can take those and say, look at the story that's being told here. Look at these elements that are so powerful and so strong. And why are they that way? Why do these speak to us at such a deep level? And we can really start to talk with people about why that is.
So I'm kind of curious, going back to a little bit of your story with these movies. You mentioned seeing them just purely for entertainment's sake, and a lot of this going over your head the first time. But after you became a Christian, did you start to learn about Tolkien and Lewis as Christians, and then started thinking, oh, I need to go back and rewatch those movies and see what kinds of things I missed? Or did it just happen that you stumbled back upon it at some point and were blown away by all of these things that you had missed before?
A little bit of both. Like in Lewis's case, learning that he was a Christian, very soon after that, I went out and bought the Chronicles of Narnia books and read them again. And you start to see the parallels jumping right off the page. With Tolkien, it was more learning about Tolkien through Lewis, learning that they had a bit of a friendship there, and learning about because the world that Tolkien builds is so vast and so huge, that it's a lot to tackle. I haven't read these books, so seeing these movies is the only familiarity I have with the stories. But I was seeking them out again. I was saying to myself, okay, if I'm seeing these things in Lewis, and I know Tolkien is a Christian as well, then what am I going to see in these films? Are there things that I just completely missed? And so as I would find time, I'd sit down and watch them again. And, you know, you still think the battle scenes are super cool and
right.
talking trees, walking around, you know, it's awesome. But then you do have more depth to it. It just brings so much more meaning to the story itself.
Absolutely. Absolutely. One of the things that stuck out to me this time that I hadn't noticed before, and it's because it had been a couple of years since I had seen this film prior to today, even though I think I had read the books another time through in between now and then. Is the richness of this world that not only that Tolkien created, and Tolkien obviously gets a lot of the credit because it's his world and he created it in the form of books, but Peter Jackson adapted these things for the screen,
sure.
and he did it masterfully. And I guess before I go any further and talk about this, because this is sort of a nerdy interest of mine. And one of the reasons I'm going to talk about this is because with this podcast, we like to do a lot of personal connections with films, because one of the great things that film does is it allows different people to bring things to the table and start different conversations. So right. as I use that as an excuse to go off into this nerdy rant, please bear with me.
Do it. Let's hear it.
But when I was working on my master's degree, I was able to study a little bit of Anglo-Saxon literature, and I thought it was going to kill me. It almost did, but it was really rich and really rewarding. And Tolkien was an Anglo-Saxon scholar, and so there's a lot of remnants and shadows of Anglo-Saxon literature in his books, in the Lord of the Rings books. And Jackson picks up on those things, and he incorporates some of those Anglo-Saxon elements into the stories with a lot of craft, a lot of subtlety, and still makes it interesting where it's not boring or unrelatable. And so one example of that I picked up on this time going through the movies, especially here in Return of the King, was Pippin and his loyalty to Denethor, the king of Gondor. He pledges loyalty to Denethor because he feels bad about letting Boromir die. What's going on there is actually a literary trope from Anglo-Saxon literature that's called the comitatus ethic. So that's a literary device that was seen in a lot of Anglo-Saxon literature, and this is what the comitatus ethic was. It is when a servant would pledge fealty or loyalty to a lord or a king, and usually they would do it in exchange for gold or some sort of reward. But when this person pledged loyalty to the lord, they needed to defend that person to the death. And it was very dishonorable for the person who had pledged loyalty to a king to not die before their lord did. So this is part of the reason that Pippin is so feels so guilty and torn about letting Boromir down, and this is why he then wants to pledge his loyalty to Denethor. And it's just kind of a really – it's a thing that I'm really fascinated by and that I think is really cool that Jackson just picks up on and works into the story. And it's something that you – that it still works powerfully on you even if you're not familiar with Anglo-Saxon literature. And I think that's a really, really cool thing. And you can pick up on a lot of these sorts of threads throughout all three of these films. And I appreciate and applaud Jackson for working those elements into the story. So, yeah. end of nerd rant.
That's a good one, and that makes me think of the way that he pledged his loyalty in the movie. You know, Gandalf is talking to Denethor, and prior to that, he basically told Pippin to keep it shut. You know, don't talk at all.
Yeah.
And Pippin just steps up, you know, out of nowhere, kind of, and just says, "Here's what happened. I pledged my loyalty to you." He's not only pledging his loyalty there, he's going against Gandalf's wishes because of that strong sense of service that he feels indebted to him by what he thinks letting him down, letting his son die.
Yeah, and then he sings that amazing song that's also difficult not to cry through.
I did read that I'm spacing the actor's name that plays Pippin, but I read that he actually wrote that. And that's, of course, him singing it. So that adds even more emotional element to it.
Yeah, it really does. And the way that scene is shot, it's really cool because the king of Gondor, Denethor, he's sitting there eating, and he's eating really violently. And you can hear the crunching of everything he's eating and everything. So you hear all this like violent eating right before these people are slaughtered.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes for a really powerful and really emotional scene that is one of those things. I think that's one of the top 10 scenes, at least, that seems to stick out in the entire trilogy.
Yeah, there's a beautiful back and forth in that scene.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about the end or the ends of the film. Maybe ends is the better way to think about it. This is another thing that Aaron White brought up, and I know a lot of people, if they do have criticisms about this film, they say, oh, it had too many endings, and it just went on and went on and went on. I know I couldn't disagree more, but I'm curious to see what you think about the endings and whether there's one that particularly stuck out to you. So go ahead and tell us about that.
This is another thing that I think not necessarily spiritually related, but maybe just an appreciation of art, maybe just growing older and appreciating art more. But when I saw it the first time in college, I did feel like it was just dragging out, and I didn't want to watch 5 minutes of two people saying goodbye and this kind of thing. But then watching it again and seeing, because one of the main things that, you know, Jackson is hailed for in this is the scenery that he brings to it. All these shots that he has, these kind of like helicopter shots flying over the landscape. And then even the close-up shots of like just doorways in the Shire, that kind of thing, and that are still so beautiful and still have these vibrant colors in such a simple setting. And that came out to me again at the end there. So you saw that a lot in Fellowship of the Ring, those kinds of colors popping in this sort of vibrant small town. And I felt like I was seeing that again at the end, more so when Frodo has gone back and he's completing the story. And I appreciated him spending time on that, you know, not rushing through it, letting the goodbyes kind of hang in the air. Because in reality, if someone goes through some sort of traumatic event like that, some life-shaping thing, and then you have to say goodbye to the person who you experienced all that with, it's not going to be a short, quick thing, you know, give them a high five and see you later. It's going to be a drawn-out, emotional, gut-wrenching experience. So I appreciate the time that he spent on that and bringing back the artistry of those scenes as well.
Yeah. And I think one of the things that speaks really powerfully to me about the drawn out endings, if you will. And I don't know that they're drawn out. I mean, we've spent what, 12, 15 hours with these characters by this point. So, I mean, 45 minutes for endings is not out of the ordinary. But I think one thing that speaks powerfully to me about those endings is, as Christians, we realize that the return of the King, and by the King I mean Christ, the return of Christ isn't just about personal victories, so us throwing a ring into Mount Doom and you know defeating whatever foe we're facing. It's also about all of the wrongs being made right and perfect justice being restored, and a return to the new and perfect Eden, a new heavens and a new earth. And I think that this film draws that out and brings out the sweetness and the glory of what that's like to experience an end that is just the start of another and better journey, like Frodo says at the end.
Yeah.
And I love that about the ending of this film. So I couldn't disagree more that it's too long or too drawn out. And I think you're spot on. I think there's something about maybe even getting older, and as you start to develop deeper and longer and more lasting friendships, you realize that goodbyes aren't short and sweet.
No, definitely not.
You don't want them to be.
Yeah, if they are, I mean, that says something about what the friendship was. You know, if you can just say goodbye real easily, then how meaningful was it really to you? How much did it shape you? And we know, I mean, especially with Frodo and Sam, they shaped each other so intensely by what they went through that it couldn't have just been a simple goodbye. It had to be drawn out. And I agree with you. I don't think drawn out is the right phrasing for it. It's just that he took his time. He took his time on an event or an occasion that earned it, that earned the time that it took to say goodbye. Because like you said, we've spent umpteen hours with all these characters and them coming closer together and building bonds together. That's not something you just spend a 5 or 7 minute scene on, you know, ending.
Absolutely. So, are there any final thoughts you would like to share with us about this film?
See, the half hour podcast. This is ridiculous. We have so much more to talk about.
I know.
Well, I want to identify an overall theme that it's not like a oh, I just discovered this kind of thing. It centers about hope. Mm-hmm. And it's something that Pippin said to Gandalf. It's a question that he asked Gandalf. So when he and Gandalf arrive at Minas Tirith, and they have already talked to Denethor, they're up in, I guess, Pippin's room maybe, but they're out on the balcony and they're looking across to Mordor. And Pippin asks Gandalf, is there any hope for Frodo? And that got me thinking, you know, hope is a central theme throughout all of this, and people are grasping for hope. But so often they're asking themselves, is there any hope? Because they may grasp for it, but they may lose it all. You know, they may lose their friends in battle, and things seem just destitute, and they feel like they could lose hope any moment. So they're just asking all along, is there any hope? Mm-hmm. The numbers of horsemen that Rohan is able to gather are too few. Is there any hope here to be able to win this battle? Arwen's life is tied to the fate of the ring. If it's destroyed, she lives. And this is something that really just occurred to me watching it more recently. And I'm not sure if Aragorn even knows about it until Return of the King here. But it's something that Elrond kind of reveals to him, that her life is fading away as the evil becomes stronger and spreads in this world. Is there any hope for her? Is there any hope to win this fight against evil? And ultimately, on a more personal level, for Aragorn to win the life of the one he loves. So just that question, not just grasping for hope, not just knowing that you have a hope, but that question of, is there any hope? And seeing all these things happening around you that would seem to answer in the negative. The steward, of course, Denethor, embodies the negative response to that, to that theme, to that question. At the very side of conflict, he's ready to abandon it all. You know, he says, abandon your post. But Sam, look at Sam, he embodies the positive response to that. He's perpetually optimistic, and he's bearing Frodo's burdens all along with him. He's telling him that there is hope, and he's literally carrying him along at points in time. So the answer, of course, is yes, there is hope, but it's that fighting that question, fighting the doubt of whether there is any hope all along the way. And each and every one of these characters have a moment here and there where they kind of wonder to themselves, is there any hope?
Yeah, wonderful thoughts. Wonderful thoughts. Thanks for sharing that. Yeah. So, since we are at the end of our 30 minutes, where can we find some of your other work and find you on social media and connect with you and what you do?
Well, I write on Real World Theology. I write the Walking Dead series reviews and movie reviews about once a month. I'm on Twitter at Wizard of Gaz. That's Wizard with no A. I also blog and podcast on clearlens.org, and that is a Christian apologetics and worldview website. We actually just did a podcast talking about a little bit about the theology of Batman versus Superman, like every other podcast in the world right now, I feel like. So that was fun. So you can find me on all those places and things and stuff.
Well, make sure you go check out Gene's work and see all the good stuff that he's doing. You can find me at Real World Theology writing reviews. And you can also find me on Twitter tweeting away opinions and thoughts on things and getting excited about Star Wars over at @DEPT_of_tourism. Please make sure you join our Facebook group and continue this conversation with us on the Real World Theology Facebook group. We have a lot of good conversations going on. And if you wouldn't mind, if you enjoy this podcast, if you would give it a rating on iTunes, because that helps other people find us. And so we really appreciate that. And then make sure you come back and join us next month, where we'll be talking about another movie. I don't even know what movie we'll be talking about next month. And I'm doing this thing, so it'll be a surprise for all of us. So make sure you come back and listen to us again next month. Thanks again, Gene, for coming on.
Hey, I had fun rewinding it with you.
Yeah, definitely. Until next time, bye-bye.
See ya.
This podcast has been a Real World Theology production. For more information, check out realworldtheology.com. And thanks for listening.
Now this is podcasting. Woo!